You. Mr. Berger. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Victor Halliday, and I was looking for my letter to the President of the United States in which I explained my age and my qualifications, and it seems that I misplaced it, but I'll proceed anyway, that I am 77 years old, started studying law when I was 63 years old, I believe it was. Just this year, I finished a course on Indian law, and this year was sent to me, American Training and Technical Assistance. This is to certify that Victor Haldane has completed a training course on constitutional principles. In witness thereof, American Training and Technical Assistance has caused this certificate to be signed by its duly authorized officer, the seal of the cooperation to be affixed there too. So when I first joined the National Indian Council of the Aging, I was placed on the legislative committee and was given the privilege to start studying Indian law out of the University of Oklahoma. This I completed with a lot of other books that I have studied on, a lot of dealing with our treaty agreements, you know, in the state of Alaska, and disposition of the people, especially our people. I went to Heidelberg when I was 4 or 5 years old, 1911, and I remember just after I arrived there, there was soot coming out of the air. And later on, I fixed my time at that time being 5 years old. And we were taught at that time by the missionaries who were there that if there was a judgment day to occur, the sky would burn. So we kids, you know, we got scared and we'd hold our hands up and see all that soot coming down. We thought the judgment day was upon us. It's about the same thing now that that I've advised the people that I met in the meetings that I've attended, that we act as if judgment day is upon us in 1991. Later on, I will produce an amendment to the act which has been held back as far as I can see. I've been sending it around, circulating it around, and maybe those who receive it do not understand it, and most of them say they had never seen it before. I will have that later on in my delivery. So I have written out here more in a chronological order what I present, what I intend to present here with documents. Maybe that I will leave this with Mr. Berger. And I have double copies of everything I have here so that you can have everything in writing. What we ourselves have said is that when we hold hearings and throughout the whole United States, I've done that. I used to go to the National Indian Council of the Aging, and we held meetings every 3 months. Now we've been cut down in our appropriation. We have it only twice a year. So I'm a board member of National Indian Council of the Aging and also a member of the United Tribes of Alaska, and off and on served as a board of directors in our own community. So I'll start here. We have been asked to state or define how the Alaska Native Land Settlement has affected our tribes or each individual. At the outset, I have expressed an opposition to place our lands under Alaska cooperative laws. For one, that we are sovereign and indigenous people of North America and of the world. Indigenous means a native of any land. or those small nations recognized in the Helsinki Accord, those third world people who have never been subdued, those people who owned said lands before boundaries were made by nations who claim jurisdiction either by conquest, discovery, or purchase. At the time of the purchase of Alaska from Russia, the Tsar wrote in a 2,000-word document that Russia had no dominion over the natives of Alaska. First, that the uncivilized races of Alaska would be subject to such laws as Congress shall pass from time to time for those Indians of that land. Treaties were made mostly to pacify Indians. Another portion of the cession treaty that is overlooked or not understood is that those people who were in Alaska, if they pledged allegiance to Russia, would have the right to return to Russia. All others who remained in Alaska, they and their lands would be under the protection of the United States. What most people fail to realize is that this clause was mainly for the Russian churches in Alaska. A greater number of the Aleutian chain. These churches in the Aleut country and in Sitka and Yakutat had many native members who had the right to go to Russia if they so chose. In the Tundra Times, Interior Secretary William Clark states, "No sovereign but state in Alaska. Question, does a secretary have the right to revoke any act of Congress? The answer is no. Only Congress has the power, and in some cases the president has, as in the Heidelberg Reservation case that proceeded to the appellate court. So what is our conception? We know for a fact that Metlakatla and Minto have sovereign immunity. And I would say that many of the villages who are going IRA and traditional government would fit in the same category. Also, I mentioned the Organic Act to set up the legislature in the state of Alaska. The advocates for the tribes faced with a recognition test maintain that both the Organic Act of Alaska and the provision for civil government of Alaska recognizes the permanence of the clan title to best legal rights. Section 8 stated that the Indians or other persons in said district shall not be disturbed in the possession of any lands actually in their use or occupation or now claimed by them, but the terms under which such persons may acquire title to such lands is reserved for future legislation by Congress. Later, fishing rights were added." I had a chance to add that clause when we met with the Secretary of Interior in drawing up the Constitution of Alaska, where the fishing clause was added. I was vice president of the Tlingit and Haida's that time and was that way for 30 years. As stated before, the Indians or persons including missions shall not be disturbed in their operation. The Court of Appeals had determined that this act constituted recognition of Indian ownership. The Alaska land transfer can be compared to the Macintosh, to wit, the Russians surrendered nothing at all, still belonging to the natives. She surrendered all right to acquire country from the Aboriginal Indian tribes. Another section that I have here was more data that we had in our meeting with the United Tribes of Alaska. "Most natives of Alaska are unaware of the amendment of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and related provisions. One, that it is placed in the D2 Act so obscure and complicated that few natives understand it. The United Tribes of Alaska was formed to carry out the mandate that Congress makes as a commitment to pass any legal amendment to Native cooperation charters, constitutions, and bylaws, and laws of the state of Alaska, notwithstanding. The portion relating to the property rights of Natives, disclaimer, and agreement in the state constitution rendered the act admitting Alaska to the Union. The state and its people further disclaim all right or title in or to any property, including fishing rights, the right or title to which may be held by or for any Indian, Eskimo, Aleut, or community thereof, as the right or title is defined in the Act of Admission. The state and its people agree that unless otherwise provided by Congress, the property as described in this section shall remain subject to the absolute disposition of the United States. They further agree that no taxes will be imposed upon any such property. Here is a clause that is codified in a case there in Arizona, that is a Pueblo case. And this tax exemption shall not apply to property held by individuals in fee without restriction or alienation. The final amendment to the act in M, Native cooperations, means any regional cooperations, any village cooperations, any urban cooperations, and any Native group. That means that even the A and B, as we advocated from the start, could have formed the cooperations in southeastern Alaska. I will show later how this was overcome by the leaders at that time. Of late, the United Tribes have received international law, the indigenous North America and contemporary international law and covenant on human rights, the Helsinki Accord, the United States also as signatories. The participating states and nations will respect the equal rights of people and their right to self-determination, acting at all times in conformity with the purpose and principles of the Charter of the United Nations and with relevant norms of international law, including those relating to land ownership of indigenous people in North America. The fundamental principles of the Helsinki Accord are the right of self-determination. Every people have the right to dispose of their property in any manner they wish. No people shall be deprived of subsistence use. This act of amendment to the Alaska Native Settlement Act on December 18, 1991, all stocks are deemed to be canceled. However, the rest of the section is the option open to the Native cooperations. Remember that not even the United States can interfere in the internal affairs of the Indian government. It says here, mention Canada. In this Helsinki Accord, as I remember, Canada and the United States, when signing this document of the whole world, the nations under the UN Charter, stated that Canada and the United States did not recognize the sovereignty of Indians or Native people, but they would scrutinize very carefully what the Helsinki Accord states and what treaties had been entered into on behalf of the Indians in the lands of Alaska and Canada. So there we have not only a treaty agreement, we also have the laws. The laws that were provided in the trade for Alaska and bought by the United States states that the Indians shall be subject to such laws as Congress shall pass from time to time for those Indians of that land. Now here is the amendment, and I may add something now and then in there. This is a part A to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, Stock Alienation. Section 1401A, Section 7H3 of the Alaska Native Claims Act is amended to read as follows. This has the United States Code 1606. And I might add that in the case of Kassan, I was in a court case with that, in that case where the Forest Service and the fisheries, the sportsmen said that Kassan had no right to participate in the act. Therefore, searching different laws that had proceeded onto the Supreme Court, we find that Chief Sitting Bull, way back during the Black Hills War, they were kept in servitude. That is what it says, servitude down in Indian country. So the decision was that any person or tribe or nation who is under the jurisdiction of the United States shall have the right to move about freely, so that the Kassan people who registered back, the 110 of them, if I had any sense, I would have signed back too, and I wouldn't be sitting here. I'd just take my $10,000 a year and forget about all these things. But I'll go on with this. On December 18, 1991, all stock previously issued shall be deemed to be canceled, and shares of stock of the appropriate class shall be issued to each stockholder share for share, subject, now listen to this, subject only to such restrictions as may be provided by the Articles of Incorporation of the Cooperation or agreements between cooperation and individual shareholders. There, it says deem. If you read any of the laws passed by Congress, you don't see the word deem to replace any act that is supposed to be binding. If it could be a mandate, it is not a mandate of Congress. It says it deems, it could be, it's a supposition, that's what it is. B, if adopted by December 1991, restrictions provided by amendment to the Articles of Incorporation may include an addition to any legal permissible restrictions. One, the denial of voting rights to any holder of stock who is not a native or a descendant of a native. That means that we ourselves can say those people who are married, the non-Indians who are married in our villages, will be able to receive stocks only by inheritance, but they will have no vote if we wish to say that. Under tribal government, we'll be able to say that. Now, two, the granting of the cooperation or to the cooperation and a stockholder's immediate family on reasonable terms, the first right to purchase or a stockholder's stock, whether issued before or after adoption of the restriction prior to the sale or transfer of such stock, other than the transfer by inheritance or the other party, including a transfer in satisfaction of a lien, writ of attachment, judgment, execution, pledge, or other encumbrances. There, we are given those rights. Forget about the 1991 one, when it says it is deemed that that the stocks will be sold. These are the things that we have the right to do. And I believe that so many people have not received this. This is one of the third amendments to the Act, and came out in 1967. In 1967, you'll find further that the Helsinki Accord was pushed by President Carter because of human rights. And he was successful in that, because further on we'll see that after 1967 is when the United States has made a complete turnaround. This, I say, is a complete turnaround from what they said from the beginning, as you will find further on. Any amendment?
Yeah. 1967. You mean 76?
Yeah, 76. 1976. That's 6 years after the Act was passed, that this amendment was added. And see, now, here is an important clause here that covers the whole thing. Notwithstanding any provisions of Alaska law to the contrary. If some of you have been to Washington and different meetings, you'll find notwithstanding to the contrary and all that. But this means that regardless of what the cooperation laws of Alaska states and had stated previous to this amendment, we can do anything we wish. We can say the hell with the Alaska laws. We are going to make our own laws. That's what it says right here. There's no way it can be changed. And I think that shows that the complete turnaround was after the Helsinki Accord was signed. Mr. Berger probably knows about that international law, which we made quite a study of. Any amendment to the Articles of the Cooperation of a Regional Cooperation to provide for any of the restrictions specified in Clause 1 and 2 of subparagraph B shall be approved. Such amendment, the affirmative vote of the holders of the majority of the outstanding shares entitled to be voted to the cooperation, and any amendment to the Articles of Cooperation of Native Cooperation shall, which would grant voting rights to stockholders who were previously denied such voting rights, shall be approved if such amendment receives, in addition to any affirmative vote placed otherwise required, a like affirmative vote of the holders of shares entitled to vote under the provisions of the Articles of Incorporation. There you have a clause that gives you the right, your own tribal government, to let the children who were born after 1971 share in the cooperation stocks. That's exactly what it says right there. So we are given the right to make our own decisions. Remember that the United States or the state of Alaska cannot interfere in the internal affairs of a tribal government. Section 8 of such act is amended to read as follows. C, the provisions concerning stock alienation, annual audit, and transfer of stock ownership on death or by court decree provided for regional cooperations in Section 7, including the provision of Section 7H3, shall apply to village cooperations, urban cooperations, native groups, except the audit and not be transmitted to the Committee of Interior and Insular Affairs of the House of Representatives or to the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources of the Senate. There, that's here's the way. We do not have to report all these things to Congress or any of these departments that are named in here. So I'll drop now to the meaning of those who are mentioned in here. M, Native cooperation means the regional cooperation, any village cooperation, any urban cooperation, and any Native group. That means the Native group in Ketchikan who were in court over the position that the A and B held, you know, in taxing that structure there. And not only that, it gives the right to any a Native organization, which means in your village, your school board, or anything like that. So that is the gist of the amendment there. And I hope that this, I've tried to explain it as best I could. But we'll go further now. This is an amendment or a resolution presented by the Haida tribe adopted by the UTA, that's the United Tribes of Alaska. This, you will note, clears the way for all the members of the United Tribes, or in fact every tribal group in Alaska, whereas plenary powers of Congress in dealing with Indian tribes is as a guardian to a sovereign nation and an independent government, as lately expressed by President Reagan in his Indian policy statement released January 18, 1933. And whereas indigenous North America and contemporary international law and covenant on human rights, the Helsinki Act, the United States also as signatories, the participating states and nations will respect the equal rights of people and their right to self-determination, acting at all times in conformity with the purpose and principle of the Charter of the United Nations and with the relevant norms of international law, including those relating to land ownership of indigenous people of Alaska. And whereas the amendment to the escrow account, section 14, so forth and so on, section A of section 2 of public law, so forth and so on, set up a fund on resources which inadvertently infringed on the right of villages who proved Fifth Amendment protection under the Tlingit and Haida Judgment Fund. And whereas the Secretary Udall in 1968 enacted a land freeze to protect lands for all Alaskan natives who were to make selections in an area of 100 million acres, out of which 40 million were to be selected by the natives of Alaska. And whereas Section 14.5 requires the regions to render advice to the villages prior to the commitment of lands. And whereas number 5 statute 698, dispute on boundaries where any boundary is disputed by the village can be settled by a board of arbitrators consisting of members of arbitrators selected by the native associations involved. Therefore, be it resolved, this resolution adopted the 6th of May, 1983 by the Board of Directors representing the villages in the state of Alaska for its use in any further dispute relative to any facet of village participation in the Alaska Native Land Settlement Act. One of the worst things that we can do, and I've tried to avoid it, is to pick on each other. we pick on Sea Alaska. I have documents that could send some of them to jail. But we should work together on what is in the Act. This is in the Act where we can arbitrate our disputes between the regions and the villages. Right here in Tlahuac, there are a lot of timber that was cut here before the Act and after the Act up to 1976. And in there it says an escrow will be set up. There's a lot of money sitting here, and I would venture to say that in the same thing that Sea Alaska did in Heidelberg, they picked these lands because they have that money sitting there. They did the same thing in Heidelberg, therefore we ran short 15,000 acres and had to pick outside the withdrawn area. Although we did prove possessory rights, and I'll come to that later, I have all the documents here that's written down on possessory rights that the Haidas were required, and I think it's along with us, required to prove in court of our possessory rights. Many of the things that came about there were attested to by older people. They said, we picked seaweed, we picked fish eggs by the ton, hung them up in trees, and we had put up our food and everything like that. And because of that hearing we had under Judge Hanna, possessory rights, we were given the right to vote on a power to the Department of Interior to set up new reservations. We were given 110,000 acres, as Woodrow Morrison mentioned, and when we went into court against the canned salmon industry, who were actual dictators of the territory at that time, we lost the case as far as the appellate court. Now, lawyers that I have talked to and the studies I've made for recovery of lands that were placed maybe illegally. I say that the canned salmon industry at that time had bought the judge out. That is what our own lawyer said. What he said at that time was, you folks go out and just cut one of those traps loose. The Justice Department is taking jurisdiction, and you are going to be sold down the river. Just go out and cut one of those traps loose, and I can defend you for destroying property, and from there it'll proceed. But at that time, a lot of us, you know, were against the idea of the stigma that was attached to reservations at that time. Some of you may remember that those people in Metlakatla were not allowed to drink in beer parlors. Those natives down in the States who were from reservations were not allowed to drink in beer parlors or even purchase liquor. And we didn't like that. That's what I call a stigma attached to being a reservation Indian. Had we known at that time what we know now, I believe that we would have insisted that go to the Supreme Court. Now, what the different lawyers say and what I've studied over appeals and everything like that, as long as a case does not proceed to the Supreme Court, we have the right to reappeal the case. So we have that option still open. I don't know if our people will do that or not. So, that is that much on here. Oh, Libby McNeil and Libby. Yeah, that is the company that we picked out. There were something like 6 different traps on the reservation that was given to us. And we had to wait for the Carlock case up there in Kodiak to be finalized, in which, when it was finalized, it stated that the natives who own the reservation shall have the right to designate any person who will be given permission to fish within 1,000 yards of Carlock. The same thing applies in the middle of Catlett. They have control of their fisheries 1,000 yards along the shore, and we would have had the same thing had we known more about reservations at that time. Now we come into an area here where the Secretary of Interior presented our case. I wrote this position papers for the Haida Nation, and it's interesting to see what he has to say. I have here marked out just the most important things. At the outside, this is what the Secretary wrote to Aspinall. Chairman, House Committee of Interior and Insular Affairs, United States Representative, Washington, D.C. And skipping down further here, at the outset, I was to point out that even while the department still was processing state land selections, we knew that substantial portions of Alaska were the subject of native claims based upon traditional patterns of use and occupancy, including subsistence, hunting, fishing, and gathering, and indeed many state selections, in fact, were the object of specific native protests. In giving tentative approval to some state selections, I can assure you that I, as a secretary, did not intend to prejudge the native claims or in any way to foreclose the native from showing their entitlement to land. I then took the position, as I do now, that proof of native ownership would bar the issuance of a patent to the state, regardless of whether or not the state land selection had been given tentative approval. As a positive indication of the department's view during my term of office, I need cite only the case of the state of Alaska versus Udall, in which the state attempted to force me through a mandamus action to issue a patent to the tentatively approved sections of the land which were also claimed by the village of Nanana. Now the word mandamus, as interpreted, and Mr. Berger can bear me out, is that it's to force the secretary to state in court what he is now stating here. It went to the appeals court and the state of Alaska lost. Only the Congress has the right to order any of its constituents or any department of Forestry or Agriculture, Department of Interior, only Congress can order them under mandamus to say what they wanted him to say here. So that is most important in there. And I will go now over here. Native villages from obtaining title to tentatively approved state land selection in all cases, as several of the bills would provide, Congress will in effect have legislatively decided such protests adversely to the natives without a hearing on the matter, on the merits. I hope the foregoing information is useful to the committee and would appreciate your making this letter a part of the records on the pending legislation. Sincerely yours, Secretary Udall. And this is what he presented. And very few have received this because it was kept out of sight. We, the Haida Nation, as states right in here, the Haida Nation position on the land land settlement. The reason goes back to the history of the possessory rights claim that we made, in that the Department of Interior, under the IRA Act, stated that Heidelberg is represented by the five tribes that constitute the nation. Therefore, in order to settle the question of cutting timber in the Tongass National Forest, they gave us the right to vote on this reservation. We did that. Many of us didn't go for it, but it did win. Cake was given the same deal. Tawak was given the same deal. Both of them voted it down. We did vote on it by a small margin, and this went to court, as I stated before, and we were beaten the case. And I believe that we have grounds in which we can revive this case yet. I have here, we are not asking for lands. We can refer to a good government in which we were made citizens in 1924 and present this axiom, applying good laws as a basis for the whole social system, its substitutes, in the case of the Act of Congress, a moral and lawful equality for the physical inequality which nature improves upon man. Although unequal in strength or intellect, we all become equal by convention and legal rights. This, in my opinion, is what we, the Alaska Natives, are asking Congress to do, to carry out the commitments that the United States assumed in the Session Treaty and the obligation on which it has procrastinated for nearly a century. The government lawyers in the case of the Lincoln-Hyder versus the United States contend that to extend special privileges to Indian claimants was thus in derogation of its sovereignty. On the other hand, the government should deal honorably to correct injustices of long standing which were well known to Congress. Such injustices have to do with the manner in which the Court of Claims on page 602 stated in brief that the object of all construction and interpretation is the just and reasonable operation of the particular statute. We, as native citizens of the greatest sovereign nation on earth, can assure history and our posterity that we are asking justice in our right, not as an agreement between a superior and an inferior, but an agreement of the United States guaranteed in the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. Justice comes from God, but could we receive it from so lofty a source, we would need neither government nor laws. Therefore, governments were instituted among men. Ours is dedicated to that proposition. As long as liberty and love of land, which are our heritage, have not become extinct, the immortal words of Abraham Lincoln can be averred, that the government of the people, for the people, and by the people shall not perish from the earth. This, we hope, can exemplify our contention that laws used by a good government are in many instances to equalize inequality. To view the statement of Robert Kennedy relative to the hearing relating to Indian allotments, we have grave doubts. With the sudden rush of applications to Indian allotments, especially the Tongass National Forest. That is just a portion of what's in this presentation to Congress. I may add something here I have marked. This has happened in the Tlingit and Haida Central Council. We have been outvoted at every issue of importance. We know that there is a lopsided, and I could just say it in my own language, because this question came about in my meeting in the Federal Bar Association in 1977. and said the Haidas have only 2 votes as compared to 50 votes of the Tlingits. So I says, can we go do anything about that? And they said, no, because the United States is on the supposition, on the principle, that one vote and one from one person is what is the guidelines for voting in any organization. But they said you can at any time withdraw your money. See, the money that was appropriated, many of you may not know, but the money that we received was $7,500,000 for all of southeastern Alaska. But we chose not to use that money per capita, but put it in a fund where it would be of use to all the Tlingit and Haidas, and that is what's happening right now. Now, we were against the formation of the board of directors, and this was written way before the Land Settlement Act. I may skip through it. The formation of Sea Alaska. To form the regional cooperation designated in Alaska Native Land Settlement Act, 5 incorporated, not necessarily members of the region in which named, their duty shall be to draw up the constitution and bylaws, regulate methods of election, and how the board of directors shall be fixed in the articles of incorporation approved by the Secretary of Interior. The Alaska Native Brotherhood had as much or more administrative authority to set up the machinery for establishing a regional cooperation. The answer to said request or a clarification of this vital question came from Senator Gravel's office dated January 18, 1972. The pertinent excerpts of his letter, quote, "The Act does not designate any existing organization to establish of a regional cooperation. The area of southeastern Alaska is the general boundary lines encompassed by the Alaska, by the Tlingit and Haida Council." So there, it is only a boundary line that was set out of which we the people should have acted. Section 7D does not provide for the election of any organization named by the named organizations, and they in turn would set the procedures of who and when the board of directors shall be elected. This procedure in a charter and bylaws would be presented to the state and the Secretary of the Interior for approval. Before such action was carried out, 12 members of the Executive Committee of Tlingit and Haidas became the board of directors of Sea Alaska plus 3 more members who were elected by resolution. The report further stated that while in Washington, D.C., and the Haida on Haida business, word came from the Department of the Interior that if 12 regionals were to receive money for operations, they must present their articles of incorporation. They must file their articles of incorporation and budget approved by January 30, 1971. According to the Act, only the 5 incorporators should have been in existence at that time. Get that. Only 5 who are the incorporators. But an order was issued by Borbridge calling the whole board to come to Washington, D.C. to present the papers. What does the Act say about the forming of regional cooperation? The Act's Section 7E states the original articles of incorporation by law shall be approved by the Secretary before they are filed, and they shall be submitted for approval within 18 months after the date of enactment of this Act. So at the outset, a big amount of money was spent unnecessarily, just as one of the first acts of the board was to set their per diem at an unreasonable rate of $250 a day. At the last Sitka convention in the Alaska Native Brotherhood, a resolution was passed to test the legality of Borbridge's selection as president of the Tlingit-Haida. There is very much material that will maybe eventually come out of that act there. The Alaska Native Brotherhood instituted that act. And I believe, if I just read my letter to the governor, this was on the request, and it covers the Helsinki Accord, international law, and our positions and so forth. And it reads, the Indian viewpoint on sovereignty. Our sovereign rights spring from an agreement of two sovereign nations, which is upheld by the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution. These laws and all laws entered into with a sovereign nation shall be the supreme law of the land. The treaty agreement between Russia and the United States stated, Section 3, that the uncivilized races in the territory shall be subject to such laws as Congress shall pass from time to time for those Indians of that land. Therefore, Section 8 of the Act of May 17, 1884 applies to the natives, even if said natives did not participate in the treaty agreement. The natives were not selling their lands, but were being subjected to a supreme law that was never abrogated at any time thereafter. The Indian viewpoint on any law, especially a treaty agreement, is dealt with in Supreme Court tests. The common words as the Indian understands it, and not as the interpreter, as interpreted by lawyers who seek to redefine the intent of Congress. The following possessory rights of the Tlingit and Haida was a precedent set for the following Alaska Native Land Settlement Act. In 1945, we were given the chance to prove in Judge Hanna's court our Aboriginal rights of fishing, hunting, basketry, land ownership from Yakutat to the southern border of the Panhandle. This action was required because the United States cannot pay for the taking of land or the failure to protect such land that came under the jurisdiction of the United States as it relates to the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution. That is why we had to prove possessory rights. The protection of Indian property rights as proven by the Supreme Court test as one is the famous Menominee Tribe of Indians versus the United States. Quote, it is now well established that hunting and fishing rights are property rights within the meaning of the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, and as such must be compensated for if taken or destroyed. I might add to this that in the book I have here from the Justice Department, and in the case we had in the federal meeting in Phoenix, Arizona, the question came up that the Tlingit and Haida were the only tribe in the whole United States that was given the right to sue for the taking of fisheries, hunting, and so forth. But remember that the case at that time was bound by the fact that we were just to decide the question of lands, and they said the fisheries were so expensive that it could not be included in the land settlement. Therefore, according to that, our fisheries and hunting, trapping, and everything of that sort is still intact. The United States has to pay for any property taken from the natives before they can give it to anybody else, so that our fishing and hunting are still intact. our subsistent rights under the Helsinki Accord is expressed that no person shall be deprived of their subsistent use in the area that they live in. Protection of Indian property rights as proven, let's jump further. The court further stated, we find it difficult to believe that Congress without explicit statement would subject to the United States to a claim for compensation by destroying property rights conferred by treaty, the right of the Tlingit and Haida survive the cession treaty, and our property rights stem from that treaty agreement because said treaty states that the uncivilized races shall be subject to such laws as Congress shall pass from time to time for those Indians of that land. Furthermore, Russia had no dominion over the Alaska natives, were never conquered, and as tribal nations retained their sovereignty. A statute of major importance was passed in 1910 concerning the function of government administration on tribal land that the secretary in relation to blowdown on timber sold and from unallotted lands or any Indian reservation or lands claimed by Alaska natives by possessory rights, the proceeds shall be used for the benefit of the Indians. There you have a point that we can use where Sea Alaska grabbed all the lands. Actually, if it goes into court, we can prove, but I want this to see us arbitrate and not to face each other in court. Arbitration is what's granted in the Act. This comes from a memorandum in 1948 which expanded the right of secretarial approval of Alaska timber which extended into the Tongass National Forest, which belonged to any Indian tribe whose possessory rights had been established. There you have it. The President of the United States gave such approval when he signed the Native Land Settlement Act in 1971. This brings us into the area of equal rights under the United States Constitution. In 1968, Secretary Udall issued a land freeze to protect those lands claimed by natives for all of Alaska. He further presented position papers affecting natives who, in effect, had proven in the United States court their possessory rights to southeastern Alaska. Determination by the Court of Claims that rather than enacting into law a proposed bill to extend to all Indians in the territory of Alaska possessory rights, the court conducted by Judge Hanna was for the benefit of the Tlingit and Haidas. In 1944, who were given a jurisdictional act to sue the United States for the taking of the Tongass National Forest. This proof of rights protected under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution as it relates to all property of Aboriginal origin, as well as land for which the Alaska Native Land Settlement Act was enacted by Congress and signed into law by President Nixon in December 1971. So in analyzing the Alaska Native Land Settlement Act, we cannot help but observe with interest this statement. It must be taken as settled law that in the absence of specific language to the contrary, the establishment of the use and occupancy of the Indians conveyed to the Indians an interest in the timber of the reservation as complete as is tribal interest in the land itself. And now, an outline of Alaska Native settlement. Since reached on this article was stated, President Reagan has issued a statement and set up a commission for Indian self-government or self-determination. Declaration of policy. There is need to settle all claims by natives and native groups in Alaska based on Aboriginal land claims. No portion of this act shall be replace or diminish any right or obligation of the United States to promote and protect the rights and or welfare of the natives as citizens of the United States. Trust lands shall mean public law 89136. The Economic Development Act of 1965 as amended shall be interpreted to include lands granted to natives under this act as long as such lands remain in the ownership of villages on or the regional cooperation. The McIntosh case in the Supreme Court tests with many other state that the tribe shall retain their sovereign right as long as the tribe lives on the land and shall retain said right forever. This is in the possessory rights case that we had, the McIntosh case, along with another law that says a custom place in which the natives switched, which is based on the Bolt decision in Washington. I have it here, but maybe I won't have time, but I can remark that there are something like 70 or 80 laws on fisheries, and a lot of it deals with the Bolt decision, and it will surprise you that the same laws were used on us in 1944. The laws that are used in the Bolt decision came in 1958, or 68, that's what it was. Under definition J, village cooperations means any Alaska village cooperation organized under the laws of the state of Alaska as a business for profit or non-profit cooperation to hold, invest, manage, and or distribute lands, property, funds, and other rights and assets for and on behalf of a native in accordance to the terms of this act. Section 3G. Regional cooperation means an Alaska Native regional cooperation established under the laws of the state of Alaska in accordance with the provisions of this act. That is all that is said about the region. They were set up by Congress in 1971, and yet most of the things that's in the act are dictating to the, they have the right to dictate to the villages. And the villages have never waived their sovereign rights. That is a point of law that I think can be overcome very easily. We were here from time immemorial, and here Congress sets up an organization, a cooperation, who are given the right to dictate to us.